Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from Business Radio X Studios. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating the heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of our elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. It's February 2nd. It's a blustery day in Atlanta, and I have Sam Grass and Lee Cantor in the studio with me this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
How are you today, Brad?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
They're not doing so well in Dallas this morning.
Little of 2 weeks ago, right?
Yeah, it's deja vu all over again.
That's right.
Does that mean it'll be here in 2 days?
Lord, I hope not. But, yeah, the Dallas office was closed yesterday. It's closed again today. And so the studio in Dallas is closed because of ice storms. And I talked to Kevin this morning. He told me that it was 12 degrees out, minus one wind chill.
You could hear him when he wasn't sledding?
Yeah. There's nowhere to sled in Dallas.
It's
I don't know
flat.
If you've been there
it's
recently, but it's pretty
right.
darn flat.
Someone's pushing him around?
Towed behind a car. So we've got a smaller group this morning, but we are privileged to have Leslie Anderson with us this morning from the Alzheimer's Association. She's the president and CEO of the Georgia chapter. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Brad. I'm glad to be here.
If we could just start with you giving us a little bit of your background, where you're from, where you went to school, how you got to be where you are. Today.
Sure, sure. I live in Canton, Georgia now, but I'm originally from Greenwood, Mississippi. Went to school at Mississippi State University, got both my bachelor's and my master's degree there. Really started off my career in the not-for-profit sector and have always been there. Started off with the Easter Seal Society, and then I worked with the American Red Cross for about 15 years following that. And I've been with the Georgia chapter of the Alzheimer's Association for 3 years now. So just from the start, I really knew that was what I wanted to do with my career and have been very fortunate to have worked with some great organizations that have done some wonderful things for people.
So you told me a little while ago that the reason you left the Red Cross was because you didn't want to move to winter.
Yes, so we had a very large restructuring, and the positions that were in the office I was in were moving to a different location, and I'm a Southern girl, so I chose to look outside the Red Cross, and I do have Alzheimer's disease in my family as well, so when I saw this, I just knew that it was where I needed to be.
That's terrific. Give us a little bit of a quick synopsis of what you do at the Alzheimer's Association, what the Georgia chapter does, how it relates to the national chapter, and just give us a little background.
Sure. I am president and CEO of the statewide chapter. We have seven offices located throughout the state of Georgia, and those seven offices were originally independent Alzheimer's Association chapters, but they merged into one chapter, and we are part of a larger national organization. There are 71 chapters across the country, and the Georgia chapter is one of the largest. I think we're number eight in budget size of Alzheimer's Association chapters, so we do have a very, very strong organization, not just here in Georgia, but also nationally. And it's something that's really only going to grow as the baby boomers continue to age, because we have services for people who have the disease and for their family members and loved ones as well. So it's something that's very needed.
Why would Georgia have such a large budget? Is there more Alzheimer's cases here?
Well, we have about 200,000 people, we think, in the state of Georgia who have the disease, and actually the number may be higher than that. Those are the cases that we know of. But I guess the reason that we're such a large chapter is just because we had so many independent chapters that merged into one. And Atlanta, obviously, is one of the larger metro areas in the country as well, so we need to have that to support the people who live in our communities who have the disease.
Let's take a step back for just a minute and you know, I think everybody has an idea what Alzheimer's is, but tell me, what is Alzheimer's?
Sure. Alzheimer's disease is actually the most common form of dementia, and I get that question a lot. What is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease? And the way I like to describe it is that dementia is a big umbrella, and think of the different kinds of dementia as being under that, and one of those is Alzheimer's disease, and it is the most prevalent, the most common type of dementia. It's I can tell you some things it's not. Alzheimer's disease is not normal aging. It's not normal memory loss. It is a progressive disease of the brain. It destroys the brain cells, causes problems with memory, thinking, and ultimately with behavior as well.
So what is normal aging then in regards to memory? So is there some memory loss just in normal aging?
Yes, there is. There's memory loss that everyone has as a normal part of aging. And when I'm giving presentations, I like to talk about that because, I have normal memory loss at 43.
This right. Is, you Sam know, this forgot is my name half an hour ago.
This is something that
say,
we
Steve?
All deal with. An example I like to give is let's say your wife has made the same meatloaf recipe every year for 30 years, and she walks into the kitchen, and she's going to make the meatloaf, and she doesn't remember that she's supposed to put ground beef in there. That would be an example. If she just forgot a recipe, that's a different story, but if it's something that a person does on a regular basis, a process they're used to,
right,
and they can't remember how to do that, that's definitely a sign.
So, like, losing your keys may not be a symptom, but trying to put the, your locker key inside of your car might be.
That is a good analogy. What we tell people is losing the remote is not a sign. Putting the remote in the freezer because you feel like that's where it goes, that could be a sign.
Right.
So if you see things around the house that are in odd places and you know they don't belong there, and your loved one has just put them there without thinking about it, that can definitely be a sign of Alzheimer's disease.
How is Alzheimer's disease diagnosed?
Through a neurologist. In the past, they've said that the only definitive way, unfortunately, was through an autopsy. But now there are some tests through spinal tap and other things that can give a really accurate depiction of whether someone has Alzheimer's disease or not. And one of the biggest advances we're seeing now on the medical front with Alzheimer's disease is early detection. We're going to be hearing more and more about that, especially as the baby boomers do age. We want to catch it earlier and start treating it earlier because that's when we have our best chance for slowing down the progression of the disease.
Is there a progressive form of treatment for Alzheimer's, or is it is there a preventative form of treatment, or is there simply a managing situation?
That's a good question because we talk a lot about the myths of Alzheimer's disease. This disease, it amazes me because there are so many misconceptions out there. And one of them is that there are ways to either prevent it or to treat it. And unfortunately, there are not. We can't prevent the disease. We do know some of the risk factors that might help delay the onset of the disease if you manage those risk factors. But we can't guarantee that someone won't get the disease with a certain protocol. And the treatments that we have, basically what they do is manage the symptoms. They help slow down the progression of the disease. But unfortunately now, there's nothing out there that will stop the disease.
If you can, develop what those risk factors that you just spoke of are.
Obviously, the first one and the one that really comes to mind is age. Age is a risk factor. We know that 1 in 4 people over the age 85 will have the disease. 1 in 4 over the age 65. If you're over 85, that number goes to 1 in 2. So age is a risk factor, although we are seeing it more and more in earlier, younger ages. In fact, one of our best, most wonderful volunteers that we have at the association is a beautiful lady who was diagnosed at 42 years old. She was at the height of her career, and she was diagnosed with this disease. And unfortunately, that's becoming more and more common. So age is a risk factor. But it's not you can get it even when you're younger. Another one is the heart-brain connection. We don't know exactly what causes the disease, but we do know that if you are at risk for heart disease, you're also at risk for Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. So what we tell people is manage those same numbers that you would manage to take care of heart disease. Watch your blood pressure, watch your cholesterol, watch your weight. Be really careful with those numbers because there is a connection there. Another risk factor is head injury. There have been studies done, and these are just absolutely fascinating studies. Some were done with World War II veterans who might have had one time very traumatic head injuries, and other studies that were done with boxers, with fighters who had more repetitive injuries that maybe weren't as severe, but they had more of them. And in both cases, there's a much higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. And we're seeing that now with football players as well. So we don't really know why that's the case, but we do know that that is mm-hmm. one of the risk factors.
Is there any myth out there that you want to dispel that maybe people think it's caused by something that it really isn't?
Yeah, you know, there are so many myths, and that's one of the things that just fascinates me about the disease, because I think partly because we're fascinated by those things which scare us, and frankly, Alzheimer's disease is a very scary prospect. It's not just letting your body go, it's letting your mind go as well. So there are always a lot of rumors and myths swirling around. For example, we heard at one time that cooking out of aluminum pots or drinking out of aluminum cans, drinking drinks made with aspartame. We don't know what causes it, but we do know that those things do not cause it. There's a hereditary component to one particular type of Alzheimer's disease, and that's the early onset, the younger onset when we're seeing it in people in their 30s, 40s, 50s. That's more likely to be an inherited type of the disease.
Is there a factor associated with this it being inherited? I mean, what are the likelihoods of me developing Alzheimer's if my father or mother had it?
You're much more likely if your father or mother had it and was diagnosed at a young age. So if your dad was diagnosed at 50, then you are more likely.
So the lady you spoke of in your office, her children then are at risk.
Are at greater risk, yeah. Yes, than the average population. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Another big myth of this disease is that it's not fatal. And unfortunately, right now, there are no survivors of Alzheimer's disease. It does destroy the brain cells. It starts off as memory loss, and it progresses to a loss of all body functions. So the person can no longer eat. They can no longer drink. The body basically just shuts down.
And is there a time period that it runs its course from early onset to death? Is there a number you can put on that?
Well, it's interesting because the journey is so different. I mean, it can just vary so widely, but the average is 7 to 12 years. Now, we do know that the earlier, the younger onset Alzheimer's disease tends to progress faster than that. But for someone who's diagnosed, say, at 70 years old, it would typically be 7 to 12 years.
And then they'll die of Alzheimer's, or they'll die of something else that this just kind of
Well, they die of usually, everything just shuts down. Uh-huh. The breathing shuts down. They're no longer able to eat. They aren't able to drink. But that is ultimately caused by Alzheimer's disease.
Which is, essentially a function of the brain.
Yes.
Not telling the lungs to breathe or the heart to beat or whatever.
Exactly.
This may sound like an odd question, but going back to something you said earlier, given the variety of dementias and given the fact that there is no preventive or curative medication, why is it important to specifically diagnose Alzheimer's?
Well, the medicines that we do have out there now are much more effective when they're started in the earlier stages of the disease. So we encourage people to find out as quickly as possible, to start taking those medicines as soon as they can. They're not going to stop the disease, but they will slow it down, and they'll give the person a greater quality of life for a longer time. But there are a lot of other reasons as well. And one is that it empowers the person who has the disease to take charge of their future from that point on. You can make decisions about who's going to take care of you, what's going to happen with your financial situation. And you can't do that if you wait too late with this disease, because it takes away those abilities. So we really encourage people, if they think there are signs, go ahead and find out. It's good for you not only physically, but because you can then take charge of what's going to happen in the rest of your life.
So with other dementias, are the treatments different?
There are several different dementias that are related to different diseases that might result in different treatments. For example, there is a type that goes with Parkinson's disease that's called Lewy body dementia. Mm-hmm. The treatments for that are more related to the Parkinson's disease. So, yeah, and the best thing to do is just to go to a neurologist.
And then in terms of, as opposed to the physical treatment of the disease with drugs or other therapies, I imagine that treatment of the various dementias are similar with respect to counseling, with respect to dealing with family members. So with the Alzheimer's Association, do you require a specific diagnosis of Alzheimer's in order for somebody to benefit from your work, or?
No, any type of dementia. In fact, our full legal name is Alzheimer's Disease and Related Dementias. So if anyone has a different type of dementia, for example, the one that usually comes with Parkinson's disease, certainly we would work with them as well.
Okay.
Are there any other myths that you wanted to speak to as far as it relates to the disease?
Well, we had talked about this a little bit, and one of the myths is that there are treatments out there that will stop it. We know that that's not the case. What they do is they typically slow the worsening of the symptoms down for about 6 to 12 months. So you are getting some greater quality of time.
What about things like Sudoku or like word problems or learning to play an instrument or, you know, those kind of things that aren't a medicine, but, you know, it stimulates the brain, you're learning. Does that do anything?
Yes, it does, actually. What we tell people are that there are some things they can do to help slow down the onset of the disease, and that's managing those heart-brain factors, staying physically active, staying mentally active, and also socially active. And by mental activities, you know, we don't mean just sitting in front of the television flipping the remote. We mean learning how to do something new, take up ballroom dancing, play a musical instrument, playing word games, those kinds of things. We've also seen the results of studies, and this one fascinates me, that show that people who are more socially active can delay the onset. And one of the studies that was done, it was conducted with a group of nuns. And the reason nuns were chosen is because they're all in the same environment. Mm-hmm. You can exclude all the environmental factors because they're eating the same thing, they're sleeping in the same locations, that type thing. And they divided this group of nuns into two. One group that said, I tend to socialize, you know, with my fellow sisters. After my day's over, we'll play cards or we'll socialize, we'll play games. And one group that said, no, I just really go back to my room and go to bed. And what they found in following that group of nuns is that the more socially active group had a delayed onset of dementia as compared to that group that was more socially isolated. So really what we tell people is, don't be isolated. Get out there, make contacts, be mentally, physically, and socially active.
What about socially, like on Facebook or like internet social? Does that count?
Well, I guess if you're my mother, it would. She is 75 years old, and she just got on Facebook last week. I was so proud of her. So for her, that's learning something new.
Right.
So that
falls under that category. It may not fall necessarily in the socialization.
But it's learning something new, right. Yes. And she calls me every day and says, how do I do this? How do I do that? So in her case, yes.
The topic really interests me. We never heard the term dementia or Alzheimer's until, 20, 30 years ago, possibly. Mm-hmm. And yet, I remember my parents talking about senility.
Yes. Yes.
Are they the same? Were they just different terms being used now? Or can you even speak to that?
Well, that fascinates me too, and I've done some research to try to find out how long this has been out here. And there have been references to behaviors that are dementia-like references back to the times of Cicero. So it's always been there. We just haven't known what it was. We haven't known what to call it. I think in the past they might have called it hardening of the arteries, senility, as you said, or simply old age forgetfulness. So I think it has always been there. I think it's always been with us. It's not a new disease. But thankfully now we've recognized it. We know how to identify it, and hopefully one day we will have a cure for it.
Now, is the objective right now to help people manage it since there isn't a cure, or is there part of your mission to actually, you know, you have research going on to find some magic pill that'll solve this?
Yes, we do support research as well. Our ultimate goal is to put ourselves out of business. You know, we don't want to be here in 50 years. We want this disease to go away. Mm-hmm. But until that time happens, we're going to do everything we can to help the person who has the disease, and just as importantly, help that family, because the caregiver often has as difficult a journey as the person with the disease does.
So along those lines, tell me what the local chapters do and what services do they provide versus what does the national organization provide?
Sure. Our services run the full gamut from time of diagnosis all the way through to the end of the journey. We encourage people to come to us early before things become a crisis. Oftentimes, we'll hear from people when, say, we'll get a call from a woman who says, oh, no, my dad, he's driving, he has dementia, and he's getting lost, or we can't find him. Those type things are, you know, you're in crisis mode by that time. We want to work with you before that so we can talk to you about how to prevent wandering, because we know 70% of people who have this disease will wander. So we want to help you prevent that. We want to talk to you about how you can take the keys away. That's something that people really, really struggle with. So we have a lot of services that can start from time of diagnosis. We have support groups. We have a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week helpline. And you may think, okay, why in the world would I need to call you at midnight on Christmas Eve? But let me give you an example. Let's say you don't get to see your mother as often as you'd like, and you go home to see her for the holidays, and you start to realize there's something not quite right here, and you want to talk to someone. You can wait till mom goes to bed and call us at midnight on Christmas Eve, and someone will be there to talk to you and answer your questions. We have educational programs, and our goal with that is to make sure that every person with the disease, whether they are being cared for in the home or in a more public setting, that they have the best care possible. So we train family caregivers. We train professional caregivers. We have programs, as I mentioned earlier, that deal with the problem of wandering, and that's something that has just blossomed really over the last couple of years. We are dealing with cases literally every month of people here in the state of Georgia who have Alzheimer's who wander. Sometimes they walk away, sometimes they drive away, and unfortunately, we do not always find them alive. It's critical that we get involved in the process as soon as possible, because the chance of finding them alive goes up by 50% if we do. So we have a program called Safe Return, and the way that works is a person enrolls their loved one in our program. We keep an updated photograph of that person on file, so if they do wander, we can get that to the media and start getting the message out. We can get the message out on the little the lottery, you know, the little scroll LED machines where they sell lottery tickets. We can get the message out there. We can issue the Maddie's call, which is very similar to an Amber Alert, but is for someone with dementia. We also can work with search and rescue to get the search and rescue dogs in to help. We support the family throughout the whole journey. We help take care of them. But our biggest goal with our wandering program is just to prevent it in the first place.
And I know it's probably a longer topic than we have time for, maybe a subject of another show, but give us the highlights. How do you prevent wandering?
There are a lot of things you can do. There are things you can do in your house. For example, there are ways you can disguise the doors to make it look like that's not really a door, so that your loved one won't know that's the way out. You can install devices that chime and make noises. There are just a lot of different things you can do. And we also provide safe return bracelets, like the medic alert bracelets.
There's nothing. They have stuff for dogs that you can find your dog. There's not anything for humans that you can put a necklace around the person?
There is.
Know where they're at?
There is. There's the medic alert bracelet. And we have those not only for the person who has the disease, but also for their caregiver. Let's say you're taking care of your wife who has Alzheimer's. You go to the grocery store, you have a car wreck. Now you've got that bracelet on that will tell the EMTs, I'm taking care of someone who has the disease and needs me, so they can go and get help into her. There are new devices that have just come out in the last year that are GPS devices.
Right, yeah, so you know where they're at. I mean, that seems like a no-brainer.
Absolutely. There are some that are available in a watch format, but the problem is, you know, those can be taken off, or for people with this disease, new things often frighten them, so they may cause them more stress to have that watch on. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So they're working on devices that will go in the heels of shoes as well.
Right.
So I know there was a couple of years ago, there was a company in town that was implanting chips in the back of people's arms, and they went out of business fairly quickly. Within a year, it's kind of one of those things, you know, mark of the beast or something. I don't want
something. Well, it's
something
a big brother thing, you know, it's a little too scary.
But have you heard any more about that, or did that just go away?
You know, there are some human rights issues with that, with implanting something in someone, and that's why we're trying to really pursue the technology that goes with the devices, for instance, that go in shoes.
Yeah, that's a little bit
that
more palatable.
Right, in a shoe or a bracelet or a necklace, it looks nice, and then, you know, make it a family picture, put it around their neck.
They'll putting it under my skin, no thanks.
Right, there's got to be a line.
Leslie, you spoke about the individual wandering. Why do they do that? I have been in clients' homes and for 30 minutes, and in the course of 30 minutes, the client has attempted to walk out the front door or climb out the window 15 times. I mean, literally someone has to almost hold their hand constantly.
Yes.
What What causes that? Is there any known reason for that?
You know, it's very, very common, and it could be a variety of different reasons. What we tell people, caregivers, is don't try to bring the person with Alzheimer's disease into your world because you'll never understand it. You need to step into their world. And it could be that they don't recognize, it may be a home they've lived in for 30 years, but they don't recognize that. They don't know their home, and they're trying to get home. It could be that they're fearful, that there's a loud noise outside and it scares them because they tend to be more fearful than we are. They don't recognize things that we do. So, you know, there are a variety of different reasons. It could be they're looking for someone who actually passed away 20 years ago.
Yeah. Right. Well, this is one of those things, it seems to me, that you're really just, it's just conjecture, right? You have no idea what's going through their mind of why they're reacting in a certain way. And that's what probably makes it frustrating from your standpoint, that you have, you know, you got to manage these people that you don't have no idea. They could be in the Bahamas for what,
that's right.
Well, you know, you have no idea what they're thinking.
Let me piggyback on that, Lee. And I'm sure you're familiar with P.K. Bevel and a program that she developed called the Virtual Dementia. Okay, it's a Virtual Dementia Tour. And what she has done is she has created a setting where she desensitizes those participants, much as we think that people with Alzheimer's has. And we're heavily involved in it, done it. I got to tell you, it only takes about 5 minutes to become so frustrated as what you were speaking to, Lee, that you want to get out. How many times have we seen, Brad, caregivers go into this setting, they know what it's about, and yet 5 minutes later, they are walking out because they're done with it, with the frustration.
Sure. And I think that's why we tell people not to try to, you can't reason with someone who has this disease because they don't understand things the way they used to. You know, if they look at you and call you by a different name, it's best just to answer to that name. It's best to go into their world and try not to cause any kind of drama. Try to keep them as calm as possible.
Let's move on. Obviously, here we've already used our 30 minutes and we haven't even begun to scratch the surface. I'd like for you, to develop, how should caregivers approach, relate to, interact with someone with Alzheimer's?
Sure. I think the important thing is to make eye contact, be very calm. Do not argue. Do not argue. It does no good. You can't win. It only makes the situation worse. Speak very plainly, very clearly, very simply. So just be as basic with them as you can. And, you know, if they call you the wrong name, if they think you're someone else, just go with it. Yeah.
So, like, if they say, like, oh, you're my spouse, and you should just go along,
just go with it.
Yep.
Yeah, just go with
it. And we're on our honeymoon, and you're like, yep, we are, and isn't it fun? And you just...
Yes.
I had one lady about 3 or 4 months ago, the same lady I told you was trying to get out, so came up, sat in my lap, and called me her honey. And that's what, you know, that's
what she
that's
believed.
Right,
that's what, and that to her is as real as if it was happening at the time.
Yes.
Is that what you believe, Leslie?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes. There's no acting involved. They're, you know, the way they're behaving is in response to the way they think things are.
Yeah. I mean, what you said is real funny. I mean, you absolutely supported everything that we try to teach our caregivers. And I tell them, get down on a knee and be lower than they are rather than above them.
Yes.
Speak, look them in the eye. Speak. Mm-hmm. Don't talk to them off to the side. Come around to where they can see you.
Sure.
All those things.
Can you share a little bit about from the family perspective, and especially in this day and age where the families aren't always that close in proximity, you know, and they're dealing with this over the phone or they're doing it, as you mentioned earlier, with these kind of, you know, semi-annual visits. How do they, how are they typically dealing with it, and what are some strategies that maybe they can deal with it a little better?
I think the most important thing is to reach out to the resources that are there. What we tell people is you are not in this alone, and you need to know that. And the journey will be much easier for everyone involved if you reach out. And I know, you know, personally, it's hard for me to ask someone for help. I'm very independent. I want to do it all myself. But this is not something that you can do yourself. You can't fight this disease alone. So especially if you don't live near your loved one, call the Alzheimer's Association. Talk to us. We'll tell you what resources are out there. We keep a database of all the resources anyone would need for managing this disease. So just reach out to us.
Another question. Most people are familiar with your memory walk. You know, it's your big event of the year.
Absolutely.
And typically it happens in the fall, I think, at least here in Atlanta. Are there other events that go on through the year that you want to make people aware of?
There are. We have a new event here in Atlanta that is really exciting. It's called Dancing Stars of Atlanta. And we did it for the first time last year. And I will admit, I got drafted to dance. We were one dancer short. And I've never been on a dance floor in my life. And now I'm addicted and doing ballroom dancing. So it's a tremendous amount of fun. But that event brought us a whole new audience. It's a great way for us to reach people we haven't reached before. It's a lot of fun. There's nothing fun about this disease. So, you know, we're trying to do something that can bring people together and they can actually enjoy themselves while at the same time supporting the work of our association. So Dancing Stars of Atlanta, the information is on our website. We would love to have everyone out there. As you said, we do also have our memory walk as well.
Tell our listeners the approximate dates and times of those two events.
Okay. Dancing Stars of Atlanta will be, I believe, April 16th. It's a Saturday at the Lowe's Hotel. You get to see some really incredible dancing. We have professional instructors that volunteer their time to work with stars from across the city, and the stars learn how to dance and compete. And then afterwards, there will be time for social dancing for the people who are there. Wonderful meal, great cause. Memory Walk happens in the fall. We have those across the state, and you can also look on our website to get the list of the memory walks that are closest to you.
Is the Georgia chapter, is it self-funding or is it supported by the national organization, or do you support the national organization with a portion of the money that you raise locally?
Really interesting question. Very, very interesting question. Actually, we have a revenue sharing with our national organization because we don't actually do the research here, but our national organization, so they support research by looking at proposals and deciding who to fund. So part of that money does go to research and also just to fund the infrastructure that's needed to keep the organization going. But we do raise the funds for our own local chapter. Absolutely.
And how many of those these memory walks are there throughout the state?
We have 23.
Wow.
I think we're the chapter who has the second most walks in the country. We have them pretty much anywhere you want to go in the state of Georgia. Mm-hmm. We've got a walk for you.
Is there any advice you can give regarding just for a person that's going through this, and that what's the thing they tell you in terms of, I wish I would have known that, you know, before. You know, a few months before, that would have been helpful.
Sure. I think probably the most important thing is to know the early warning signs. Go on our website. The 10 early warning signs are listed there along with some examples of what those signs might be. If you see those signs in your loved one, take them to the doctor. Go early. Go with them because you may see things that they're not necessarily seeing or are not necessarily willing to tell the doctor. One thing we found, especially early in this disease, is people are very good at hiding it. They don't necessarily want others to know what they're experiencing and going through. So be cognizant, know the signs, look for them, and then if you think your loved one may have the signs, go with them and talk to the doctor.
We really appreciate that, Leslie. Thank you very much. If our listeners would like to contact you or the Alzheimer's Association, can you give us a telephone number or website?
Absolutely. They can call 1-800-272-3900. And that number is answered, as I said, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We also do have our website. It's www.alz.org/Georgia.
We certainly appreciate that. I think that I can speak for Brad. We'd love to have you back on the show, especially as it relates to the Dancing with Stars
Wonderful.
Of Atlanta. Let you promote that a little bit
love
and maybe generate a little more interest.
Yeah, great. Sam wants to get a team together, right?
Hey, listen, I know how to ballroom dance.
I really want to explore the topic of the conversation taking the keys away because it's a perennial difficult topic.
It is.
Is that the biggest challenge for families you find?
You know, they're all challenges. Another one is mismanaging finances. That's one of the ways that a lot of people get diagnosed is their loved ones realize they're sending a lot of money to telemarketers or they're paying some bills twice and not paying other bills at all. So I can't really say that there's one challenge that's worse than any other. They're all tough.
Right.
Well, obviously, we need more than 30 minutes to adequately cover the subject, so we will be more than glad to have you back on the show.
I'd love to be back.
Thank you very much. We need to wrap it up. That's it for today. We certainly thank Leslie for being on the show today. Thank you, and we look forward to having you back. We want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today and remind them that if they wish to listen to a rebroadcast of the show, they can do so at eugeriaradio.com. And in closing, we'd like to say that if the youth of our nation is its greatest national resource, it goes without saying that the seniors of this nation is its greatest national treasure. Thank you. God bless.
Eugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and broadcast live from the Business Radio X studios.